This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about big data, what it is, how it's used, where the potential pitfalls are in personal privacy. For instance, we love being able to get recommendations on what to buy or watch, recommendations fed by our preferences gathered over years of leaving data trails. But when the same kinds of data can help to trail us, let others know about our whereabouts, or even predict if we might be likely to commit a crime, well, that's when big data gets super creepy. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Always comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. What do you know about big data, and what are you worried about? We welcome into studio Jim Stotter, who's a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute here in Hartford. He'll be our guide in studio throughout today's conversation on big data. Jim, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll mention that I also do some research at the United States Coast Guard Academy, but my opinions expressed are purely my own.
Yes, your own opinions today. Joining us by phone is Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, who's professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford. He co-authored a book that is keying our conversation today, Big Data, a Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. He joins us today by Skype from Austria. And Victor, welcome to our program. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So how would you define big data, Victor?
Well, big data is often seen as a new technology, as a new software tool, but it really is something different. It's our ability to gain new insights into the world, into reality, by having vastly more data points available relative to what we want to study, relative to the phenomenon that we want to understand, than we ever had before. That enables us to predict the spread of the flu just by looking at what people search for through Google. That enables Amazon to make 30% of its revenue by making product recommendations, and that is helping Google's self-driving cars to find their destination.
You gave us a few examples right there, but give us one of your favorite examples of how collecting these data sets in the way that we're able to now and crunching the numbers, we're able to do something that's really, really useful to us. Because we'll get to some of the scary stuff later, but let's talk about something that you like that's really useful in our lives.
Sure. One of the things that I really liked is that a researcher team up in Canada at the University of Ontario is looking at how they can help premature babies. Premature babies are particularly vulnerable and prone to die of infections that are discovered too late. And so what these researchers did was to collect a lot of vital signs, digital data from these babies, thousands and thousands of data points per second overall for days and weeks, and dozens of babies, and then looked for pattern that with a high degree of likelihood predicts the future onset of an infection. And they found such a pattern. So today they can predict with a significant degree of likelihood that a premature baby is going to be sick even 24 hours before first symptoms manifest themselves. And that saves lives.
It does, and it's a very interesting use. For you, Jim, I mean, is your definition of big data and its best uses, is it much different from Victor's?
Maybe a little bit. I mean, I work as an economist, so I tend to think about the way that it's changed what we can know and the ways in which we know it. And, you know, for example, I was trained, you know, as a graduate student to do a lot of economic statistics, and that would be completely impractical without modern computers. So that's the bigger data of the past, not the truly big data of today. Today, the way that we draw conclusions from huge masses of data is rearranging our thinking about coming to economic and statistical conclusions. And I'm also interested in the way in which it changes what we're able to do and our rights, our property rights, our personal human rights, things like that.
And we'll be talking about privacy a little bit more later, but talk about some of those other rights. That's an important and interesting issue.
Well, I mean, for example, the privacy thing, most people think of it merely in the negative sense, but I heard Google's top economist, a guy named Hal Varian, who's very famous in economics before he went to work for Google, say that the internet in some ways is the greatest boon to privacy in the history of the human race because people can ask things that they would be very uncomfortable asking their partner, their parents, et cetera, like, you know, how do I know if I have herpes, you know, how do I know if I might be gay, things like that.
Interesting. Does that resonate with you, Victor? I mean, this is a lot of what we seem to be talking about has to do with computers crunching big numbers, but a lot of this has to do with human interactions, human data points. I mean, it's really all about human behavior at the end of the day.
Well, not only about human behavior, big data also helps us predict the weather better and many other things out there in nature. For example, when parts in the machinery break even before they break. So these predictions are go far beyond our ability to predict human behavior. But predicting human behavior is quite powerful. And in the realm of economics, of course, we can now cast, that is, predict in real time certain behaviors and look at it from a macroeconomic perspective. For example, make relatively good predictions about inflation rates just by looking at how price points change online for products that are sold through e-commerce.
Right. I have a little interesting point on that. It's there's a project which Victor is indirectly referring to called MIT's Billion Price Project. Ricardo Cavallo is an economist at MIT. He happens to be from Argentina. And one of the interesting uses – let me just tell you a little what the Billion Price Project is. It uses its so-called scrapes data from the internet on prices, you know, prices of everything from travel to books, and creates literally a billion price database and compares that to the official price statistics of the government, which of course only come essentially with a 1 month lag. And it finds, the good news is, it finds it's very, very close historically to what the government does. The interesting thing about the Argentine researcher who did it is they used it to – this is sort of big data being used in a popular or defensive way against big government. They essentially used it to show that the Argentine government was lying about the rate of inflation, which they said was much lower than most people thought it was. And they were saying it was about 10% a year, and they found it was more like 20% a year.
If you want to join us with some thoughts about big data, 860-275-7266, and some of its best uses, maybe some of its more scary uses. We're talking with Jim Stotter from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Hartford. Also, Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, who wrote this book, a co-authored a book called Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. And this is where we live. So, Victor, what got you interested in this in the first place? Why did you decide to write this book and tell this story about big data?
Well, the book is co-written with my friend Ken Cookie, a data editor at The Economist magazine. And together for a number of years, we brought about three dozen leading thinkers in the internet area together for a retreat once a year. And about 2007, 2008, these folks started to talk about a phenomenon, started to talk about something that wasn't about e-commerce. It wasn't about social media. It wasn't about internet or web 2.0. It was something else. And really in the focus of that, in the center of what they were talking about, was a new role for data. The data now in itself becomes very valuable, turns into a resource, an economic resource. And they were talking about how using the data, they could get insights into our world that otherwise they would never have been able to. And so we didn't have a label at that time that we really liked, but eventually we succumbed and accepted big data as the label for that.
Are the companies or governments that use big data best, are they the ones that are essentially the biggest, the most able to collect the most data points, or can this be scaled in some way, Victor? Is this something that smaller users with powerful computers can actually get their hands on as well?
You know, what is really interesting is that in the past, the mantra was always, particularly on the internet, bigger is better, and scale really matters. But it was also true for factories in the industrial age. And what is really interesting today is that, yes, bigger still matters, especially when we talk about data. But sometimes startup companies or even individuals are so well placed to ingest a lot of data or to access a lot of data that they become very important and very successful big data players. I think we will be joined later in this by Oren Etzioni, who's one of his startup companies really did billions of calculations every single day for hundreds of thousands of customers. And if I recall correctly, they only had 24 or so employees. So really small companies can have a huge digital footprint as long as they have access to data.
Do you feel that the scales are tipped, Jim, toward bigger companies? Or do you think that we really have in some ways leveled the playing field where startups and even, you know, people in their basements and bedrooms can find ways to use these large data sets to their advantage?
Well, what we're talking about is really the cloud there, is the storage of data, not on your, you know, laptop hard drive where it would never fit at the scale imagined, but that you can, you know, tap into it, that someone else is Amazon or Google is storing. And it's still the case that scale matters very much there. I mean, there's possibilities of more distributed storage of things, but there's, I think, still a privacy and curation issue of who is ultimately responsible for that data. But it helps in the direction of leveling, that you can have access to it, you know, usually for a fee.
Almost always for a fee. That's right, because there's dollars attached to this data. Victor, before we take a break, you've written about big data being responsible for a mind shift in how we think with this a new datafied society that maybe has us thinking about data a little different way. What do you mean by a mind shift?
Well, you know, one way to look at it is that in the past, we did collect data as well to understand the world, but collecting data was really very costly and time-consuming, so we collected as little as we absolutely could get away with in order to prove or disprove points, in order to help us make important decisions. And therefore, we already needed in the past to have a question, then to collect the data in order to answer the question. In the future, we'll be able to collect data comprehensively, and that means that not only is the data then able to answer questions that we had already when we collected the data, but we can use the data to help us come up with new questions, questions that we didn't even think of were important, but that as we are looking at the data and looking at the patterns in the data become important. That's how the folks at Ontario found out that the pattern for these premature babies that predict with a high degree of likelihood that they will fall sick is not that the vital signs go haywire, but that the vital signs suddenly stabilize. Totally counterintuitive, but found out through big data.
And Jim, that's interesting from an economic standpoint, too. Economists have been grappling, honestly, with some of the same big foundational questions over hundreds of years. But now it seems as though there are new questions that you can ask every day. You look at the data and you say, that's a question I never thought to ask.
Right. I think in some ways it really makes the questions bigger and better and deeper. You know, for example, in statistical modeling and testing, which is what I mostly do, you know, traditionally you're very worried about the confidence level. You know, in the election season you always hear, you know, with a margin of error of 3 points, which is a, you know, a quick and dirty way to say it, incomplete way to say it. But that really depends on the size of the sample. Well, the size of the sample is often not a problem anymore, and sometimes it isn't even the sample. It's everyone. So those issues of mere statistical certainty really fade into the background, and you're able to concentrate on more fundamental questions like what kind of assumptions are you making? What kind of models are you making? And so there's almost a kind of meta statistic in which you are doing statistics of different models, different ways of looking at the same data. You're not so much dependent. I like what Victor said on the expensiveness of the data. So you're really being stingy with the data. That's not a problem anymore.
You know, just to put a finer point on it, I always have people ask me around presidential election time, you know, how accurate are these polls anyway? And they say, well, look, you know, 1,000 people who are likely voters, that's a pretty good sample size, and you're going to get to within a couple percentage points of something. But you really are, Jim, saying something entirely different. What if the, you know, it wasn't 1,000 out of a million, but it was a million, and it
exactly.
was all of us. And then all of a sudden, you really start to get much finer, and that's really what we're talking about here. It's the ability to fine, in a fine-grained way, figure out how people are thinking, not just maybe likely to vote.
Right, and then it becomes more the question of the question itself, because everyone who does polling knows that it's extremely dependent on how you ask the question, who's asking the question, when, et cetera, by what means, telephone or face-to-face. So, you know, you get to the more important stuff in a way of trying to figure out what people are really thinking, because the sampling problem either completely disappears or becomes, you know, trivial, of very little interest.
We're looking at the big and little uses of big data on the program today. When we come back from our break, we will be joined by Oren Etzioni, who's one of the big pioneers of big data. We'll hear his story, and we're going to hear from you as well at 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Hope you can join us on Wednesday at 4 p.m. at Firefly Hollow Brewery. It's in Bristol. We're going to be talking about the craft beer explosion in Connecticut. We may even be sampling some beers. I'm not sure. If you want to find out more about how you can join us for this special taped broadcast of Where We Live happening at 4 p.m. on Wednesday, just go to our Facebook page at Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking about big data. The book by Victor Meyer Schoenberger is called Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. Also joining us in studio today is Jim Stotter, who is a professor at Polytechnic Institute in Hartford. Joining us by phone now is Oren Etzioni. He's CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. He's one of the pioneers of big data, founding Faircast and Decide.com. He joins us today by phone from Seattle. Oren, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Your story of how you founded Faircast is prominently displayed in Victor's book early on. Maybe you can tell us that story. It helps tell a big story about big data.
Sure. Victor's book really is a great book, and it does a wonderful job of showing how we can use big data for good. In our case, it was a case of using big data to help the consumer fight back a little bit. We all know how the airlines change the prices on us all the time, the airfares. You look at the fare 1 minute, and it's $200. An hour later, it can be $300, then back lower than you started, et cetera. This happened to me personally on a flight, and as a computer scientist, I decided to fight back. So we gathered what ultimately became a trillion data points, and we were able to make pretty good predictions, kind of like weather predictions, about whether the airfares were going up and down, and we made that available to consumers for free so they could make more informed buying choices.
So what did you need to do to solve that problem? So you, like many other people, got burned by paying too much for a ticket, and you said, I want to take on this problem. What were the hurdles you needed to overcome to make this a possibility, notwithstanding the trillions of data points you need to gather? But talk us through that.
Well, that's a great question, because we emphasize in the conversation about big data the actual data, but there are really a few other key ingredients. First of all, you do need the computer power to analyze it, and that's becoming more and more available, particularly as mentioned earlier, right through the cloud. You also need the expertise. One of the sexiest jobs these days is being a data scientist. It turns out that you can't just take big data in a computer, mix it together, and it'll work. We hired a team of data scientists and worked hard to refine the set of variables you need to consider and the algorithms themselves that guide the computer. And only when you put all these things together do you start to get meaningful predictions? And then last but not least, it's very important what's called the user interface, which is how do you expose that to people? Because when our conclusions aren't certain, when we're not 100% sure, it's very easy to have the conclusions be misunderstood.
This idea of helping people shop for something like an airline ticket, it's obviously opened up an awful lot for consumers, but I can only imagine, Oren, that as you were developing this technology, the airlines and some of the other big companies were saying, okay, well, if they're going to play at that game, then we're going to have to figure out a way to make it so that we can continue to have people pay too much for an airline ticket. I mean, in some ways, is this a little bit of an arms race here, or are there certain battles like this one over Faircast that perhaps the consumer has now won?
Well, you're right. It is an arms race, but it started in the 70s. So airlines have been collecting data since then, and we're already doing quite a good job of manipulating the airfares and trying to maximize their revenue. So what we were trying to do is much more to level the playing field, to play catch-up, as it were.
You have referred to big data as a big pencil. What do you mean?
Well, so I think it's important to separate the technical know-how and what's happening there from the policy decisions that are involved. So big data, the computers are really a technology, and you can use it, as I was trying to examine, for the consumers, for good. And, of course, it can also be used for tracking to penetrate and even eliminate people's privacy. So I think it's important to have a vigorous policy discussion about how we want to use the tool. And at the same time, there are those of us who are continuing to develop better tools, obviously in the hope that they'll be used for good things.
Victor, I'm wondering if you can comment on that. The tools needed that Oren and others have utilized versus these big policy questions. Tell me how you view this, because they're different, but of course they're all very, very connected.
Well, the fact is that 10, 20 years ago, we just didn't have the storage and processing power available. So many of these questions just weren't on the table. What has changed over the last maybe 5-10 years really is that computing and storage power is now available, not just overall, but at comparatively affordable cost. And so suddenly what used to be almost impossible or could only be dreamed of now is possible. And that means that we now are facing these very important questions. You know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, nobody could hope to, no government could hope to wiretap every telephone conversation because there just wasn't enough magnetic tape and magnetic tape recorders around to do that. But today, the data amount in the world has increased so significantly. There is a saying that from 1987 to 2007, it increased 100-fold, that we can actually capture a lot of that data. And that means we as a society now face very important questions. I completely concur with Oren that we now as a society need to find answers to these questions because the questions of the small data error or the answers of the small data errors are not able to give good results to the questions and the situation that we are faced with in the big data era.
Jim, I'm wondering if you can comment on that. If you feel as though in some ways the rapid rise of computing power has gotten ahead of our intellectual, emotional, moral capability to have some of the conversations that we need to have about the ramifications here.
Yeah, I think it definitely does get ahead, and we try to catch up. But I think there are some encouraging signs, and in another way, it's a new world of exploration, which is extremely exciting. I think especially for young people who are at all interested in these fields. And I'm going to echo something that I've heard a couple of well-known computer scientists say, that regardless of what field you are in, for example, Zuckerberg, in college, you should study statistics, you should know how to code, and you should study machine learning, and then learn one other thing, one other specialty that you're interested in, because regardless of that specialty, whether it's history or economics or even literature, there are increasingly going to be big data approaches to the study of that.
But that's, as you were saying that, I was thinking, well, and hopefully maybe study philosophy, maybe hopefully sure. study something that allows you to think through the ramifications of the thing that you're making. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg in some ways is a really perfect example of that. He and Facebook, it grew into something that has become culture. It's not a part of culture. It's not a company. It's essentially culture in America and around the world. But the ramifications of that maybe aren't clearly thought through, nor should they have been by, you know, some kid in his college dorm.
And I want to bring it back to Oren here. I think in some ways the power of the data has allowed us to slide over or not worry about older, more fundamental questions. So, for example, in economics, there's a distinction between merely being able to predict something, you know, which is often all you care about in some context, and you don't really know, as Victor says, you don't need to know the why, you just need to know the what. And all you need is a lot of correlation. You don't need structured causative theory. But for other kinds of questions, for policy questions, for strategy questions, and just for deep understanding, we want to know that why as well. And then with Oren's work on, you know, bringing logic into it, it's not enough to just have more and more data. You know, you have to know what questions to ask, and, you know, chains of reasoning are still very important, and in some ways become much more powerful now that we have these tools. So the old questions are still there.
Oren, could you pick up on that a little bit, maybe expand on what Jim just said?
Sure. So the work that I and my colleagues are doing today at the Allen Institute, we're actually looking at the limitations of big data and asking what's next. So as far as the limitation, as you can tell, many of us in the field are very optimistic about the things you could do with big data. For example, as you mentioned, the ability to generate high-quality product recommendations where Amazon and Netflix and others make a lot of money. But we've all had the experience where the product recommendations are really terrible. They're showing me, you know, presents for my wife's birthday that I bought quite a while ago. And that's because it turns out that we cannot be reduced to a simple vector of variables and values, which is what big data does to radically simplify it. And if I have more of those vectors and more data points, that's not enough. We need to understand what's going on. We need to build more sophisticated models. And so now the question becomes, how do we do that? And that turns out to be a research question very much at the cutting edge of the field called artificial intelligence. And it's not some scary nebulous thing. It's about taking these tools and algorithms and building the next level so, again, we can do a better job with these questions and also with questions like, well, can we build a better model of cancer? Can we build a better model of climate change and understand what's going on, not just collect the statistics?
Jim, did you want to jump in?
No.
Oh, okay. When we come back from our break, we want to bring Sarah Watson into the conversation, and we want to talk more about some of the worries about privacy and big data. Privacy is, of course, something that we're constantly worried about as we every day give over more and more information to the government and companies. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to check back in on some stories that we've been covering recently, including what Puerto Rico's economic crisis means for politics and people on the island and off. We'll also find out what high school graduation rates really mean in Connecticut and beyond. You can join the conversation coming up on Tomorrow's Where We Live. Today we're talking about big data. We're thinking about this through the lens of the book Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. It's co-authored by one of our guests, Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, one of the big data pioneers who is profiled in this book is Oren Etzioni, who's the CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. He joins us by phone today as well. Jim Stotter is here from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Hartford. And joining us by phone now is Sarah Watson. She's a technology critic and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Sarah, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
We wanted to have you get us into this question of privacy, which we've touched on so far. You've written in this Living with Data series in Al Jazeera an article titled The Issue Formerly Known as Privacy. Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, what's privacy mean to us in these days?
Well, I should give credit where credit is due, and that's Julia Angwin's terminology as she described in some of her work at ProPublica. But it really resonated with me because I think in part the word privacy doesn't really contain all the concerns that we might have with the way that big data is used or influences our lives. And so I've been talking more about it in terms of the personal impacts on our autonomy, our ability to make decisions about ourselves, to understand how the world is judging us, basically.
You mentioned that Facebook, for instance, is exposing parts of its algorithm to users so they may have more insight into the way it works, getting maybe a peek behind the curtain. You find this exciting. How so?
I do, yes. So it's a new feature that they're introducing. So when you look at a person's profile or you kind of hover over their image on your feed, you can choose to see it first, so quote, see first. And that's their way of letting you kind of have some control over who you want to be kind of watching or seeing their information first. And I think the big problem has always been that Facebook's algorithm was really opaque. And so, of course, things like we can kind of interpret that, you know, the more pictures you're tagged in with someone else, the more likely you might be interested in what they're doing. Or you like their status a lot, or you comment on their posts a lot, and that might be influencing how often Facebook chooses to resurface their new post to you. But there hasn't been much ability for individual users to say, no, I like this is the way I want it to be. These are the people, and some features existed before to do that, but. I'm really excited because I think it both shows that Facebook is willing to expose some of that control to users, but also that users are starting to care about having control over what the algorithm is showing and not showing in the newsfeed.
And that gets to something that Jim and I were just talking about during the break, something you've written about is the strange sense that Facebook, for instance, or many other services has a little bit of what we like right, but not everything. The data doppelganger that kind of looks like you, but isn't exactly like you. And the more we use these things, Sarah, the more we want to say, hey, no, if you're going to do this, actually reflect my real thoughts and values. Don't just reflect what you think I like.
Right, exactly. And that gets actually back to the big data analysis of what we're kind of doing. So all of our data trails are kind of showing our previous behaviors and our transactions, but there's not much about why I'm doing it or how I'm doing it or, you know, what my intention is. And so a lot of that assumptions, they're inferences about me. So when I looked at my aboutthedata.com, which is a data broker's kind of profile of individuals, and also I looked at Google Ads. So there's kind of a feature where you can look and see what Google says about you or what your previous behavior looks like. And some of those details said that I've completed high school, which is obviously not as far as I've gone in my education. It says that I'm a truck owner and I intend to purchase a vehicle soon. I've never purchased a vehicle ever. very city dweller. It said I purchase plus-size clothing, I play shooter games, I'm interested in gourmet cooking, horses, gangs and organized crime, and needlework. So a lot of those things say nothing about my real interests. And it starts to make me wonder, okay, where did that data come from in the first place? Because I'm not going to, you know, gangs and organized crime articles or kind of blogs or forums. Maybe it's because I really like The Wire. So there's this disconnect between why, you know, on the one hand, I can see what the advertising companies think is going on with my profile, yet I still don't know why they think that. And more importantly, I don't know how they might use that information to influence my future experiences and behaviors.
And Victor, this is an interesting question. With a lot of data comes, I suppose, a lot of noise and a lot of false leads. And the story that Sarah paints there is one of someone who is somewhat known, but not completely known by the algorithms, by the data collection systems that she uses.
Well, yes, and there is a lot of room for improvement. Oren said just as much a little earlier. That's what he and many others are researching about. But as we are able to collect data more comprehensively and do sophisticated statistical analysis on it and deep machine learning, we are getting better. And it's interesting because when Amazon started to toy with product recommendations first in the 1990s, their first system was based on small data. And when they tested the system, one of the guys who was looking at it said it was like going shopping with a village idiot. That is, it knew a little bit, but most of the time got things wrong. And Amazon's recommendation system has improved so significantly that today it apparently accounts for a third of its revenue. So in that sense, we are getting better, and there is still a steep climb. But the approach, the method of collecting vastly more data at comprehensive scales and then looking at it is the appropriate one compared to the small data approach.
Kyone Wolf, our technical producer, just sent me a very important little message here, which suggests that WNPR producers tasked with finding something new to research every single day, imagine what the Google searches find out about them, because they're literally searching for everything under the sun on a daily basis. Let's go to the phones. Al is calling from Danbury. Hi there, Al. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. What's up?
So I had a question, since we're speaking about privacy. You know, we often talk about government using our data to find out what's wrong with us, crimes we're committing. But is there the possibility that the government could start using data to find out issues that citizens are interested in, especially as voting becomes less popular? You know, could our internet searches become sort of our virtual votes on the things that are interesting that we may not, you know, go to the polls to, you know, tell our legislators?
This is interesting, and Al, you see this as potentially a positive. Obviously, it could be a negative as well, but you see this maybe as a real positive, people listening to what people care about.
Yeah, pretty much.
Interesting. Thank you so much for the question. Sarah, I'll put that to you first, but I'm sure our other guests might want to jump in.
Sure. I mean, I think there is a lot of potential for that information to kind of indicate where the interest is going or where the interest lies. But again, it goes back to the question of, well, you know, is this an indication of a desire? Is it a problem? Is it a kind of real concrete concern? And how should we go about doing it? But on the more important piece is that, you know, whether or not governments even have access to that data in the first place is the primary concern.
Oren, what do you think about that? I mean, obviously, you've been a pioneer in trying to empower consumers so that they can fight back against big corporations. When it comes to things like government, often individuals say the government doesn't really care about what I care about. Politicians who are running for office aren't talking about the things that I care about. But the more this data becomes available, there's a chance that maybe government can tune what it does to the needs, wants, desires of the people. What do you say?
I agree. I think it's a great question, and it illustrates the two sides of the coin. In other words, it can be used for good. Big data can be used for good or not good. And the tools are already available today very easily. So if you think of trending topics on Twitter, Those are things that indicate what people care about. And if you think about searches on Google, as the example that Victor gave earlier from his book about how they were able to assess flu trends using Google searches. So I'm quite confident that particularly candidates today, political candidates, are studying Google searches to understand what's on people's minds. And ultimately, I think that can be a very positive thing.
Victor, I wanted to get back to something that our caller, Al, though, referenced in your book. You talk about some of the issues that big data is able to solve, including predictive policing. This is something that I think people can both see as a positive and very definitely a negative. Maybe tell us a story about how that works.
Well, predictive policing is the desire and the application of big data in law enforcement or by law enforcement agencies so that they can predict at what day, at what time, and in what area the next crime is going to be committed. It sounds a little bit like the Hollywood movie Minority Report, but that's the kind of direction that this is headed. Now, it does come with quite a number of problems to it. And when we look at the potential uses, both positive as well as problematic, what it really underscores is that our privacy, our rights as citizens, can no longer be protected using a mechanism of notice and consent or informed consent as we used to do with privacy. What really is important in the future is that that the use of the data that is being collected is responsible and accountable, because some uses are good. Some uses, even by government, is good. Helping government planning and providing better services to its citizenry. But some uses by governments and some uses by corporations are highly problematic. So we really need to focus on how the data that is being collected in the big data era is being used, for what reason, for what purpose, and constrain some of the most problematic uses, but enable and facilitate some of the beneficial uses.
You know, Sarah mentioned this a moment ago, Jim, but I think it is really an important question. I made a joke about our WNPR producers searching for all sorts of different things, but I can imagine post the terrible tragedy in Charleston, people who are increasingly interested in white supremacist groups, who are increasingly interested in terrorist groups, maybe interested in guns and weaponry, and maybe they're looking for information for themselves, not necessarily to do anything bad, but just to learn more. This is all there sitting right next to the same searches that people who do have intentions to do bad. I mean, how do we suss these things out, Jim?
Right. I don't know, but I think it can be useful to take a historical look at this, that every new technology, fundamental new technology, gives us new powers, which both have to be limited, but in some ways can expand freedom and need to be enshrined. So an old example, but a good one, is copyright as a child of the printing press, which both limits your ability to copy, but also makes it useful and profitable for the person holding it to copy. And Victor, I think, mentions in his book that, in effect, free speech is a child of the printing press, because speech wasn't important enough to enshrine before that. So I like Sarah's idea of more than privacy. You know, that privacy is an older concept, and you know, we have new abilities for good and for ill, which we need to reconsider, and it's going to be a long time fighting it out.
This is somewhat along these lines. We just got a tweet from Clementissima. What about big data and intellectual property? What about the potential of pirates mining the ideas of others? And this is, of course, something that dates back a long time. People have always stolen others' ideas. Now it's just easier.
Right. I mean, it's stealing ideas is fine. And Picasso said somewhere, good ideas get borrowed, great ideas just get stolen. And, you know, so in effect, that's why whenever there are big idea revolutions, people always congregate together to share their ideas, to steal ideas and to get notoriety for their ideas from one another. So it's a social intelligence that happens, and that's happening on a bigger scale now through these technologies. So it's but we do need to think about different kinds of intellectual property, and in one I'm particularly interested in, and this goes to the Berkman Center that Sarah Watson is associated with, or has been associated with. There's a guy who works there. I very much admire, Yochai Benkler, who talks about how increasingly things are created by very, very large collectivities. So where individual property rights, intellectual property rights, really don't make sense anymore. You know, things from Google apps to Wikipedia to lots of kinds of software are in effect created by millions of people and on an ongoing basis. So what do we mean by property rights there?
Sarah, do you have a quick thought on that?
No, I mean, I think the biggest piece that I'm kind of concerned about is that, you know, we're not being able to kind of understand the full use of how data is being used, either in government context or corporate context, particularly as consumers. And so I'm really kind of concerned about the ways that we can kind of define our normative judgments about how what a good use is or what a bad use is before we even know how it's actually being used.
Well, I was going to ask, though, how do we get to that? I mean, I spend a lot of my time covering politics and talking about what happens at the Connecticut State House. And I think sometimes big questions like this come up in front of lawmakers, and they're, frankly, through no fault of their own, ill-equipped to deal with some of these because they're not subject experts. And mm-hmm. It seems, Sarah, as though we're needing to really arrive at some of these judgments, figure out the rights and the wrongs of how this data is being collected and then used. Sometimes in a little bit of a vacuum, we're far behind the curve in a lot of ways as far as knowing what questions to ask, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think ultimately we just need more examples. And some of that's going to come out of industry as more things are, more kind of applications of big data are made available to people and made kind of public. But I think a lot of this goes to investigative journalists. I think it goes to researchers and trying to expose the ways either that the technology is meant to work or the kind of secondary effects of the technology. So a really good example of that is some work that just came out that suggests that high-income jobs are shown more often to men than to women in Google online advertising results. And that was a study done by Carnegie Mellon. And a lot of that is just it takes time to expose some of those examples.
Well, yes, and I think, you know, just like predictive policing, I mean, predictive policing might show that neighborhoods that have had a lot of crime in the past will have a lot of crime in the future. And it seems as though that's a problem, Sarah, in that it creates a really negative feedback loop, a feedback loop that maybe will perpetuate some sort of ongoing social problem, even without knowing it. Boy, there's a lot more that I'd like to talk about, but we've run almost completely out of time. So I want to thank Sarah Watson, who's a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. She's written extensively on these issues. And Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, John.
Thanks also to Oren Etzioni, who is the CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Thank you, sir, for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And thanks to Victor Meyer Schoenberger, who is the co-author of Big Data, A Revolution That Will Transform How We Live, Work, and Think. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
I want to thank our friend Jim Stotter, who's a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Hartford, for being our guide through today's conversation about big data. Thanks so much, Jim.
It's my privilege.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to wnpr.org/where we live.